If you know us, you may know that we love a good conversation, even or sometimes especially maybe if it's uncomfortable or difficult. But this year, as we head into what seems to be only conversations that are uncomfortable or difficult, how do we and the collective we here best do that? And if the idea of even talking to someone now about really anything deemed to be political gives you pause, then this is the episode for you.
So, full disclaimer, the connection quality of part of our conversation is a little iffy in places, but it's really worth listening to every moment of this episode. Our guest today, a repeat guest at that, talks us through the journey of compassionate dialogue, including practical tips on how to practice this in your next conversation. Importantly, how to do the inner work necessary to make this the default rather than the exception to your conversations in 2024 and beyond. Welcome to the Dear White Women podcast, the show that helps white women use their privilege to uproot systemic racism without centering themselves in the process. We are your biracial Japanese and white hosts, Sarah and me, Sasha. Well, welcome back to Dear White Women. Would you please introduce yourself to our audience?
My name is Dr. Nancy Dome, and I am the founder and executive officer for Epic Education. And I just came out with a second book last week called Compassionate Dialogue Journey, where I'm kind of digging deeper into this idea of compassionate dialogue. And so a lot of my work is just around working with businesses and schools and supporting them and how to have these important, difficult conversations, but kind of lead from compassion. And that's really the work that I get to do, is talking to people and supporting them to show up with empathy and kindness while still doing what needs to be done.
I think anybody who's listened to our show or who is watching the news nowadays knows this is a very challenging time we are in, and there is a need to have difficult conversations at the moment because we have a lot at stake. And I love that we're able to bring you back on the show and help give our listeners some really much needed skills that we all could stand to have refreshers on. The original show that we had you on with us was back in episode 164, which aired in April 2022. And that was when you first introduced compassionate dialogue to us, this idea of recognize, interrupt, and repair. I remember you talking to us about the four communication styles. Me, Sasha, and I were totally different: functional, intuitive, personal, and analytical. And so I wondered if you could do two things for us. Could you give us a brief definition or an understanding of compassionate dialogue, especially if the definition has changed somewhat over the last few years? And also, as you've done this work even more since we spoke to you, what have you learned about this structure?
Yeah, well, those are both great questions. So I'll start with the definition. So compassionate dialogue really is in the service of three things. One is interrupting harmful language or actions, right? So when we first think about compassionate dialogue, we think about this interpersonal interaction that happens when someone says something that is, you know, maybe unintentional or intentionally hurtful, that triggers us and that we need to respond. But a lot of times, because we're caught off guard, we don't really know how to. So compassionate dialogue supports us with the skills to say, I want to interrupt this behavior or this action, right? So that's one way. The second thing that we really, I think, got clearer on in the last couple of years was that it was also in pursuit of deepening, like, coalitions and relationships, that when you're like just the two of you being in partnership and working together, there's times that conflict might come up. And how do we use compassionate dialogue to not only resolve those conflicts, but to deepen the relationship? So this idea that through these difficult conversations with each other, we're actually building these stronger coalitions with one another, that we know that we can rely on each other and support each other and depend on each other. So that's the second thing. And then ultimately, compassionate dialogue would be in the pursuit of self-care. So how are we taking care of ourselves by not stuffing the things that really should be expressed, but because we either culturally or just, you know, where we are, position, power, all those things, that we end up stuffing a lot of our feelings because we don't really know how to let them out. And what we see that happens is that when we stuff a lot, eventually it's going to come out. And so how do we, in the pursuit of self-care, share what we need to share in the moment or as close to the moment as we can, and so that we're not carrying and building resentment, right? So it's all in this idea that we are doing it through showing connection and empathy for each other, though. So I'm going to interrupt, but I'm going to do it from a place of seeking to understand where you're coming from, seeking to deepen the relationship, and making sure that I'm taking care of myself in the process. And I think that, you know, we feel, you know, someone could hear that and think, well, that's, you know, super selfish or whatever, but I can't take care of anybody else if I'm not taking care of myself first. And so the healthier I am, the better I am in my relationships. So that would be the kind of big picture description of what compassionate dialogue is and what it does. And then, of course, the RIR protocol, the recognize, interrupt, repair that you mentioned would be the how we go about it. So, yeah, and I would say that when I think about where we were when I first, you know, talked to you both and where I am now, I think the biggest change is, like, with the second book, it was really more about more of that empathy and this true desire to grow, to mature myself, to really be in the self-reflective place where it's, you know, and you notice I've used the word pursuit several times, and that's really how I think of it now, is that it's a journey, but it's the pursuit means that it's constant, that it's ongoing, that we're constantly, as things change, we are still learning and growing. And so the compassion dialogue journey, in some ways, I don't know if softened is the right word, but I think that what it did was, because it's still difficult, and it's still messy, but I think what it did was really start to look internally at, like, how did I end up here in the first place? What is that stuff that I'm carrying that would be really healthy for me to unpack and let go of, and so that I can move forward? So it's a lot more of this self-reflection and then thinking about, how do I contribute to what's showing up in front of me? You know, especially if you start to see patterns in, like, the relationships that you choose, or, you know, the people that you work with, or the kind of dynamics that you see yourself constantly over and again, and you don't know how you got there. I mean, that's a lot of self-reflection. So I think that's kind of the evolution of really now this work is about working on ourselves, right? It's a workbook. It's very task-driven with a lot of opportunities to reflect and practice. Whereas the first book, Let's Talk About Race and Other Hard Things, was really just informational. It was really about understanding what the protocol was and showing case studies about how it works and, you know, where people struggled with it. This is really about a journey for ourselves.
Thank you so much. I think that's the journey piece, and in particular, your use of the word pursuit and that focus on intentionality is something that Sarah and I really believe as well. It is really important, right? We love that this is a workbook, this book, because it really speaks to the practical side of, this is all wonderful, but how do we do this, right? How do we do this in our lives? And in particular, I love that there were so many questions in that sneak peek that we got of the first chapter of the workbook. You know, a lot of why and how and all the questions I really deeply love. We'd love to sort of pull a few threads out, because one thing that really stood out to me is you have a discussion in there about the good, bad binary when it comes to people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's such an important thing, because we talk a lot on the show about how, you know, first of all, many things can be true at once, and it's, things are not necessarily a binary, but in particular, this good, bad binary, as you discuss it, this use of these labels, right, hold us back from really having compassionate dialogue. So can you talk a little bit about that and why this was important to, you know, set sort of level set at the start?
Yeah. So I think that in our society, especially now with just so much influence, external influence coming in, we have these pictures of ourselves, and it's like, I'm a good person. And so when I do something bad, it's hard for me to reconcile that, because then that makes me a bad person. And that's that binary part. And what I'm really trying to get people to understand is that I can be a good person that makes mistakes and do bad things. And conversely, you can have, you know, a bad person who will do a good thing. And we've seen it happen. And so understanding that when we're able to admit that as good people, we will make mistakes. We will say the wrong thing. We will put our foot in it. I do it on a regular basis. You know, that it doesn't take away from me being a good person. It just means that there's something I get to work on, Right. And I think that's important because when you only see yourselves as either or, it's hard to admit that you made a mistake because somehow that changes your perception of yourself. And so we really need to broaden that perception by saying, you know what, I'm a good person and I'm going to mess up. They're not, you know, mutually exclusive of each other, and making room for that. I think that social media has on some level kind of undermined that gray area because we're always presenting, you know, this the best light that we never actually get to see people being humans, you know, making human errors like we do all the time. We only see the best parts of it. So when we actually do get caught on tape, you know, making an error, people lose their minds about it, whereas it's normal. And so do we create space to normalize that we're going to all mess up at some point and give ourselves grace in those moments and then also rectify it?
I love that you said that because I keep thinking about, you know, several conversations that Sarah and I have had about defining people by their worst moments, right? And the question of when people mess up, which we all inevitably do, right? Is that the defining moment of your life and how it has become that for certain people? But also removing that binary seems that we can, you know, understand that we can be both. And that there is growth, and it goes back to that intentionality, I think, and the journey that we are continually learning. So I really love and appreciate that that's where you kind of start, right? Foundationally, when they think about compassionate dialogue, they're thinking about dialogue with someone other than themselves, right? As opposed to starting, you know, from within. And I think this is something that rings true for us too. Like, we talk a lot about that inner peace being super important. And how do you see this self-introspection piece of equity work, right? Really leading then to having those harder conversations with others or being present in those uncomfortable moments.
Yeah. Well, so two things about that. That's actually why I start with the good, bad binary, is because if I can then understand that there is more gray and that I'm still a good person, the things that are going to come on, you know, throughout the workbook, which are really going to ask us to honestly assess, you know, ourselves, it makes it easier for me to kind of point out those blemishes that I have if I can start off with a strong understanding that I'm not either or, that I'm going to have moments of both, right? And then this idea of needing to start internally and really understand, like, how am I showing up? How does my lived experience influence and impact how I'm engaging with you? You know, what is that baggage that I have that I may not have ever investigated, but that's definitely impacting how I'm engaging with you, right? And so that introspection is necessary for me to kind of own my own stuff so that I can then move forward and then start thinking about, so when I'm looking at a dynamic and I'm talking about us, that I actually am able to see how I might be a contributing factor to whatever that dysfunction is between us, right? And it also allows me to really see where I am in relationship to even where I'm working and things that I'm doing, right? So I think a lot of time we kind of build a story in our head about what we should be doing or what we should be feeling. And I don't know that we've actually created a lot of space for us to actually know what we're feeling and doing. One of the hardest things about the RIR protocol for people has typically been the first R, which is recognize. They struggle with naming feelings and actually knowing what it is that they're feeling because we've been so unaccustomed to that level of just taking a second and just saying, wow, you know, I'm angry or I'm sad, or, and what does that, you know, if I distill down a little further, what is that sadness? And usually sadness comes from anger, you know? And so being willing to say that I'm angry and what that means and how I typically act when I'm angry, you know, some people shut down, some people get loud, you know, so that I can get out of my own way and still engage.
That is such an important part of that. And it's interesting to be able to name that, because I know as a parent, you focus so much on giving your kids the words and the labels when we're not really giving ourselves that space. So I almost feel like you gave us all permission to spend the time and inquire. And like, even if you get that gut, like be in tune with that moment that something doesn't feel right, what might that be?
That body knowledge that you just talked about is really like what we're trying to get at too, is like your body knows before your brain can name it that something is wrong. And so we need to start understanding how to interpret what our body messages are. You know, what does it mean when it's in my gut as opposed to when I'm flushed, or as opposed to when the hair on the back of my neck is going off, as opposed to when I get chills? Like, we need to stop long enough to interpret that, because our body is telling us something and it's rarely wrong, you know? And so we just got to listen and then know what that is.
We're also gearing up for what Misasha and I talk about is the most important presidential election in American history, right?
Yeah.
And I just want to say, hopefully this it's the last time we're saying this, because we said it in 2020. And also, hopefully it's not the last time we're saying this, because we no longer have elections in this country. And I said it, but I'm not joking, sadly.
Yeah.
And politics is one of those things that I think we're now very much, like, people already say, oh, I don't want to talk about race. Well, people really also do not want to talk about politics. And yet, I think it's a very critical time where there are really lasting repercussions of this year's elections. And so what do you think, for example, people need to keep in mind when it comes to having difficult conversations with people around politics in the broadest sense of the world in this environment here in 2024?
Well, first to answer it, I think that there's some real things that come up. And this goes back to that body knowledge, right? Because unfortunately, we're in a time that our differing opinions could actually lead to my harm, right? If I actually articulate them. And this is where understanding the messages that your body is giving you is really important, to know that there is actually a time that engaging is not the answer. Right. And so, and I say that not because I'm trying to get people afraid, but I think we really have to pay attention. You know, I live in rural Montana, and there's some conversations that if I felt like I could safely have them, I would. But there are definitely some conversations that I avoid because I'm not actually sure I'm safe. And when I say safe, I mean physically safe, right? As opposed to feeling uncomfortable and naming that as a safety issue, right? And so I'm constantly in this place of analyzing, like, is this the right time to have this conversation? And also looking for my exit routes. And I'm not saying that to sound extremist. I really do. I am seriously concerned about this upcoming election and where I live right now, and whether or not I can stay there during the election or not. And so as I think about the larger question about, you know, the conversation, you know, if I'm like, I've been in California because winters are too cold in Montana, and I have a girlfriend who, we are completely on opposite sides of this. And we had our first sane conversation about it. And I say sane because the other times was a lot of her kind of just going off on, you know, all the conspiracy theories and all the things, and me just, like, you know, trying to use the protocol, but her not hearing it. But this time, really just having time and using the protocol and asking better questions to get her to, so that I, with my desire is that I'm trying to understand where she's coming from, and then asking the questions that helped her come to some maybe different conclusions on her own, instead of me telling her what was wrong with what she was saying. Right. But because I also have a lot of energy around it, I'm still in that practice place of learning the right questions so that I'm not reacting. I don't know if that makes sense or not. You know, I want to respond, but sometimes I'm in my feelers too. And so I have to mitigate myself. And again, that goes back to me riding my own emotional wave so that I can get to a place to ask her some good questions.
Could you share a little bit more about that? We're so far apart potentially in this country, depending on who you're talking to, that that people's defenses instantly go up. And so this example you just shared about a friend that you were having these conversations with, what were some of the questions that you found helpful to bring her, like, the conversation forward?
Yeah, you know, I would say that, like, one was really about, one question I asked her was, like, when you're, so she made a prediction about, like, about something big was supposed to happen, you know? And so she was wanting to make sure I wasn't on the road because things were going to happen and it was going to be bad and it's going to involve, like, worldwide travel. And one of the questions I asked her was, I was like, so, okay, let's assume that you're right, but let's say, what happens when it doesn't happen? So this whole prediction, you're not traveling, we got all these people not traveling, what happens to your thought process if this event doesn't take place? in the time frame that you say. And she thought about it and she said, well, it's a good thing. I was like, but that's kind of a cop out. Like, it's a good thing means that if it happens, you're validated. And if it doesn't happen, you're also validated. And it actually doesn't work that way. I said, so I really want to invite you to think about if it doesn't happen and you can go back and start thinking about all the other predictions that you were told about. Is there any way that you're thinking that you might just want to investigate more? And she said, you know what, actually, yes. Like, and it was all about like, I'm validating her. And I think that's an important piece is that she believes us. So there's nothing I can say or do that's going to change it. So the conversation is trying to lead her in a direction that says, like, don't take even what I say as truth. I want you to figure out how to validate your source, how to go back and dig deep and figure out, you know, where this is all coming from and make your own decision, not, you know, independent of me and what you're hearing. And so our conversation went back and forth like that. But I felt like for the first time we got to a place where she was like, you know, maybe I need to. And she actually said that she realizes that she had, there's been a lot of influence over her and she's been feeling like she's out of her body. Right. And so I think that when you're submerged in either side, either anything, that without anyone externally coming from a place of love, and I think that was really important, is that, you know, her family, there's people in her family who aren't talking to her. Right. And when they do talk to her, it's in judgment. It's critical. She can't hear it. We shut down. And that is the compassionate part. It's like, I'm not going to shut down. I'm going to listen. And I'm also not committed to you having a different opinion. But what I am committed to it is that we're going to hear each other. Right. And I'm going to listen to you with love. And so I think that that was the first time I felt that, again, I wasn't trying to change your mind, but that I felt like she was doing her own self-reflection and asking her own self then some questions or putting some things on the plate for her to do to maybe start to challenge some of her ideas.
I appreciate you also shared, first of all, that example, but also that you chose to stay in it. Because that was when you were speaking about that, I was going to say, what do you say to the people who just go, I can't handle this. I'm out. I don't want to have this conversation. Like, I'm going to cut you off. Because I feel like that's what's also happening with this polarization is that people aren't choosing to, for whatever reason, engage and stay.
Yeah. You know, so what I personally, I know that it comes down to relationships for me, which is why it's important that we have strong ones, is that if I'm in relationship with you, if I've loved you for 20, 30, 40 years of my life, I'm not throwing that away. Right. And so that keeps me in it. It's interesting too. I was doing a session and a Latino man in the session, he's like, I want to say that I have a lot of respect for you. I'm like, okay, the other shoe's going to drop now. Because that's a disclaimer. I have a lot of respect for you, but he's like, but it bothers me that I'm having these conversations. He's like, it bothers me that you wrote in the book that you felt that you wanted to educate, you know, your friend's parents. And this was in the first book. And he's like, because it always falls on people of color to kind of take the higher road and do the education. And my reply was, I was like, you know, there's different people in this world for a reason. There's people who have to be out there marching. There's people who have to be, you know, or a better example is you got elementary school teacher, middle school teachers, and high school teachers. And they're all three very different people. And your elementary school teacher does not want to have anything to do with a 10th, 11th grade. You know, so this idea that we each bring our skills. So my skill is around people. And so I'm not going to let our differences be what separates us. Now, it could happen at the end. The repair could be that we separate, but it's not going to happen because I've walked away. And what I try to encourage people to do is to, like, if you're in relationship with these people, you know, then it's got to be worth trying to figure out how to get beyond this, because this will not be the only hurdle. It feels like things are just getting harder in some ways. And so, you know, there's so many other aspects of people that are beyond this one idea that are we really truly going to throw this all away because we're voting for someone different? And so for me, the answer is no. But I also want to have that, I want to be that critical relationship too. I want to have those critical conversations that lets us have an equal understanding of each other's perspectives and the impact, right? So this election has a great impact. And so if I'm sharing that I don't know if I can stay in my home during the election, I hope that has an impact on you so you can understand beyond everything that's being fed to you that there are real implications behind what's happening. And that in some ways, I may be in more danger if he loses.
I think that's a really important point. Yeah. And I think making it very personal and, you know, coming back to community and relationships and how we invest in those relationships and how those relationships in particular are the ones that we fight for when we have these compassionate dialogues or when we come back and try again. And I think about it also, you know, Sarah brought up parenting. I think about it through a parenting lens now as I have kids who are now old enough to have very strong opinions and some, and one kid in particular who needs everything to be his idea first in order for it to be actionable, and how you need to start with validation there and then move past validation to questions, right? And challenge. And I think that it seems so simple when we talk about it with regards to our children, but when we talk about it with regards to our friends who are the same age, it becomes something much more complex. And so I really appreciate that you have sort of distilled it back to this, these very simple human desires, right? And wanting to be heard and validated and then perhaps challenged, as opposed to, you know, to remove those defenses, to remove the immediate impulse to be like, well, I'm done, I'm out, this is it. Because when I have been talking to high school students recently, a lot of their concerns have been around, how do I talk to family members who feel so drastically different? And how do they address that when this has been their whole life, you know, and these are foundational relationships that they are questioning, how do I do this? So I think that this is so, so important. And I hope that, you know, that coming out with this practical workbook really gets people to think on, you know, more deeply on the how can I do this in my own life, in my own circles, because that is where the influence comes from and lives. What we really want to hear from you is, what is that key thing that you want our listeners to take away from this new workbook, from your work, from this conversation that we had? Like, what else, you know, didn't we ask you, or what do you think you really want to share?
You know, I think ultimately it's this idea that we are all connected, right? We're not separate from each other. And I truly believe that we need to remember that. But I think we've forgotten that. I think that we have become so very isolated and we've created these camps. And our survival is going to be dependent on our ability to work together and to communicate. And I also want to remind us that at no point in history was there ever this assumption that everyone should think and believe the same way. And we have in the last, I don't know, 10 years gotten to this place that, like, if you diverge any place, you know, religious beliefs or, you know, who you choose to love, and if there's any divergent from me, then somehow we can't be connected. And it doesn't make sense. In fact, it is our uniqueness that and that makes this kind of whole mosaic where we thrive together, right? I mean, imagine everyone being just like you, right? And how limited that would be for the world. And so I think it is, you know, if there's anything that I want this workbook to do is for us to remember that we are all connected and we can all be part of the solution, and that it doesn't hurt us to be empathetic to others. And I don't have to even agree with you at the end of it. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you love through the process, and I'm going to show you understanding, and I'm going to acknowledge your perspective. And then I'm going to also let you know that I don't agree with it. And I'm going to share the impact for me. And hopefully that gets us to kind of meet each other somewhere in the middle, which is more what I, at least, you know, I'm a child of the 60s. That's more what I was used to, this idea of that we found compromise and we found our commonality, which I think is far greater than what separates us.
I think that is so important because, you know, your point about how we have shifted in these past 10 years to this sort of polarized, incredibly polarized, right? That we either have to agree or we're sort of mortal enemies viewpoint. Is like, when I think about, I mean, there's been a lot of conversations about democracy recently. And when I think about like the truest form of democracy, it is that there are multiple opinions out there. It is that we all have the ability to participate in this process. And it is that, you know, we listen to each other. We may not agree, right? But the ability to have your voice heard, the ability to have everyone's voices matter in the process is that foundational thing. So I really appreciate that reminder that you, you know, gave us to focus on those commonalities, right? Because we have so much of that out there.
And we have more to gain
Yes, 100% more to gain, because we really have everything else to lose, right? If we can't do this. So if people want to get this workbook, as they should, if people want to find out more about you, where can they do that? And also, besides this workbook, what else is coming up for you? Tell us everything.
Yeah. So the book came out, I want to say 2 weeks ago, and it hit number one, which was great on the first day, bestseller. So that was, I think people are hungry for it. And we did it's called Heart of the Matter. It's on my website, drnancydome.com. And we wanted to do a beta in-person retreat kind of style event and really talking about the heart of the matter, which is like compassionate dialogue and really merging that kind of head, intellectual thing with this spiritual, like this growth, this development, looking at the body, the mind, and the spirit all together and not separating them out. I think typically there is this idea that we have to address these all separately. And so we wanted to show that all of them really do, in fact, need to work well together. And the weekend turned out to be one of the most moving things. And we worked through parts of the big activities in the workbook. And so it reinforced to me that what I was hoping would happen with the workbook really did. And this idea of building community, building networks, and knowing that there's other people who are feeling and struggling, around the same things, that you're not alone. And I think that's also part of that isolation. So that's something that's exciting. We are hoping to do 3 a year around this idea of marrying the body, spirit, and mind together. And then just for me, the events and the things that I do can be found on my website, drnancydome.com. The book is available on Amazon right now, and we'll be opening it up like we did last time with the other book to other retailers. But right now it started on Amazon.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing this time with us. We really enjoy connecting with you every time we get to do this. We're very excited for you. And this is such a needed approach to our relationships, our communities right now. So thank you very much for continuing to do this work.
No, oh, thank you. And thank you for having me again. It was nice to see you both and to be able to share this message. My goal is always to make a positive impact, wherever I can. And I think we need to be more open in talking about love as being one of the components needed to challenge a lot of this harmful kind of rhetoric that we're seeing, and not be afraid to bring it up, but also know that we got to challenge it. Like, it's not, compassionate dialogue has nothing to do with sitting back and warm and fuzzy. In fact, it's really difficult, and it forces us to step into our own discomfort. But I think that it's imperative that we know that we can do that, like that we're able, and empowering us to know that we each need to be involved to make a difference.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've just listened to the Dear White Women podcast with your hosts, Sarah and me, Sasha. Yes, we're on social media. And yes, you can hire us to do talks about our book. But the biggest thing, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter to receive our free materials. Head over to dearwhitewomen.com to get on the list.